Welcome back to the program. Donald Rumsfeld, who served many controversial roles in government, had an interesting philosophy. He often said that the solution to a small and tractable problem was often to create a much bigger problem in the hopes that it would break the logjam. In some ways, Dwight Eisenhower, our 34th president, subscribed to a similar idea. In order to avoid fighting small wars, which he was totally opposed to and which he thought would get out of control, he created the bluff of the potential of a much larger nuclear Armageddon. In so doing, he set the country on a path to prevail in the Cold War. Now, author, journalist, and professor Evan Thomas takes a look at Eisenhower's secret battle to save the world. Evan Thomas is the author of the best-selling book The War Lovers, a biography of Robert Kennedy, and the very important The Wise Men. It is my pleasure to welcome Evan Thomas back to this program to talk about his newest work, Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. Evan Thomas, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Good to have you here. One of the central ideas of this book and of Eisenhower was that he just didn't want to fight small wars anywhere.
Well, he'd been to war. He'd run a war, World War II, and he had intimate experience with the cost of war and the uncontrollability of war, that war is a kind of a mutating monster, and politicians and statesmen who think they can control it are fooling themselves, Eisenhower believed. And so as president, a little counterintuitive when you think about the Great Warrior, but as president, he was just determined to keep us out of any war, and he did. After he got us out of Korea, which took about 3 months, he never committed combat troops again for the next 8 years, lost no soldiers in combat. And, no other modern president can make that claim.
And it's interesting that beyond his experience as a commander, and certainly you talk about he had visited so many battlefields and so many locations after battle, he had never actually been in combat himself.
Yeah, it's surprising when you think of him being such a war hero. But he missed World War I because he was home training troops, much to his chagrin. And then, of course, by the time World War II comes, he knows too much. He has too many secrets. He's too valuable to expose to the front lines. But he would regularly go to battlefields, and he saw a lot of carnage. And the one incident that really got my attention, he flew in a small plane in 1945 from Berlin to Moscow over the route taken first by the German army and then the Russian army coming back, and he saw not a single building left standing. He wrote about this in his memoirs, and it had a profound impression on him, going to concentration camps and seeing what that was all about. That, of course, affected him. You know, war changed him, and when he came home, he was just determined to keep us out of anywhere. Now, it's not like he wanted to just come home and say, well, I hope the world just goes away. He was an internationalist. He knew that America had to be involved. Soviet communism was, on the march in those days. You look at a map in 1952 when he ran for president, and it's turning red, Eastern Europe, Asia, incursions all over the world. And so he felt he had to stand up to communism, but he didn't want to fight them on the ground in a conventional war.
It's interesting, as clever as he was and as devious as he was, in a good sense, as Richard Nixon said, much of his ability to bluff the way he did came from the fact that he had this tremendous credibility because of his role in war.
Yes, I mean, this is sort of a bluff. People say, well, isn't this some great strategy that we can learn from President Eisenhower and that other presidents can use? And I say, well, yes, but. Yes, it's good to think that war is dangerous and you want to avoid it, but this bluff that he pulled off really is something that only a supreme Allied commander with Ike's cred could do. Other countries looked at him and they said, this guy means business. After all, he conquered Germany, Nazi Germany. So it's a bluff that not every president could pull off. So I'm not sure how useful it is as a strategy for other presidents, but it worked for Ike and it worked for the United States.
And one of the things he realizes early on that you talk about is that there was no strategy for dealing with communism when he comes to office. After the death of Stalin, he finds that there were no plans whatsoever.
Well, there were no plans to figure out what to do with the Soviet Union after Stalin died. There was the United States had a containment strategy, which Eisenhower basically endorsed, to contain the Soviet Union. But there was a lot of debate about how we were going to do that. A lot of people in his own party, in the Republican Party, wanted to roll back communism. That was the word they used, roll back, push it back out of Eastern Europe. And Ike, you know, that sounds good, but Ike as a military guy knew how hard that was going to be. And so he basically endorsed the Truman administration's idea of containment, but in his own way, he wanted to save money. This is interesting. You know, you think of, again, the great military man. Well, he cut defense spending by 20% as a two-term president. Interestingly, President Obama has been reported to be looking at Eisenhower on this and mm-hmm. asking his aides, how did he do this? You know, how did he cut defense spending by 20%? The answer to that is he cut the heck out of the Army, because since he wasn't planning on fighting any ground wars, he cut his own, you know, this is his own service from World War II, and of course his old comrades in arms were pretty distressed about this, but he cut the Army so that he could build up the Air Force and the Strategic Air Command, which of course needed missiles and planes in this new nuclear age. But he had a very beady eye on the military establishment. You know, Ike was the guy who gave the famous speech about the military-industrial complex at the end of his presidency, right, saying you got to watch out for that. And Obama's, you know, this is flash forward 50 years, Obama's still dealing with it.
But he certainly spent a lot of money building up our nuclear arsenal around this idea that he added to containment this notion of massive retaliation.
Yes, he did. And massive retaliation basically was saying to the Soviets, if you come at us in any way, with the proxy wars or whatever, we reserve the right to strike back at the time and with the means of our own determination. That was code for nuclear weapons, and the Soviets understood that. It was a big bluff, I mean, as I say in the title. I was fascinated by this. Would he ever have used these weapons? I don't know, because he never told anybody. One reason why I wrote this book was because I learned early on that his closest advisor, General Goodpaster, never knew whether Ike would have been willing to use these weapons or not. And I thought, wow, what a awesome responsibility to hold, to never tell anyone under what circumstances you'd actually use these terrible things. I think he probably wouldn't have used them after the first couple of years. They might have used them early on, but not that. But I don't know, because he didn't tell anybody. That's a pretty big, talk about the loneliness of command. You know, that's a pretty big burden to undertake.
Part of what you see in the massive retaliation strategy, and what you talk about, the speech that John Foster Dulles gave about that, is how hands-on Eisenhower was in every aspect of developing policy and putting that policy out there to the public.
Absolutely. I mean, at the time, the press, being, you know, I guess the press is even lazier than they are today. I say that as a member of the press. But they missed the boat. They thought this was all Dulles' doing, this massive retaliation, because he gave the speech. This is useful to President Eisenhower. It was useful to have Dulles be the bad cop, the threatening guy. Well, he was off playing golf. Well, turns out that Eisenhower wrote the speech, or he wrote the key words in the speech about massive retaliation, and let Dulles take the credit, or the blame, as the case may be, for coming up with massive retaliation. You know, he had this amazing kind of confidence, Eisenhower did, that allowed him to be kind of humble and modest and let others take the credit or the blame, just kind of hanging back and running things behind the scenes with what the professor named Fred Greenstein called the hidden hand. It was a hidden hand presidency. But he had the kind of confidence that would allow him to do that. He didn't have to be the smartest guy in the room. He was willing to kind of hang back and let others put others out front while he actually controlled things.
It was the ultimate example, I suppose, of leading from behind.
It was. I mean, his experience. He was not a great combat commander in World War II, but he was brilliant at taking these big egos: De Gaulle, Stalin, Churchill, Roosevelt, and managing the war in a way that let everybody get along well enough in order to go on this great common crusade. That took amazing political skills, and it took the suppression or the subordination of his own ego, or his ability to manipulate the egos of others.
How much of that did he learn when he was chief of staff for MacArthur, learning what not to do in many
respects?
Well,
absolutely. I mean, that's just the right point. I mean, he worked for 9 years as chief of staff to General Douglas MacArthur, the great General MacArthur. Well, MacArthur was vainglorious and full of himself. You know, was a braggart. he was a military genius, but he was always showing off, and Ike learned that's not what the way to go. The much smarter way to go is to be low key and let others be out there, but you work things behind the scenes in a modest way.
In many ways, coming back to what he would have done or not done with respect to nuclear weapons, it's complicated as you write about Eisenhower, and we see really two guys in the story. One who was very warm and genial and friendly and grandfatherly, and then the cold-blooded temper that was Eisenhower.
Yeah, I was talking to my best source in a way for this book was Eisenhower's own son, John, who's now 90 years old, but believe me, he has all his marbles. And we were talking about this, and the balance between the genial, sunny Ike and the cold-blooded Ike. And I said, well, you know, 50-50. And John Eisenhower smiled, and he said, well, I'd make that 75% cold-blooded. This is the guy's own son. So he was a complicated guy and a very tough guy. Beneath that smile, and it was a wonderful, warm smile, there was a very, very tough guy.
Talk a little bit about really what was the first major crisis of the Cold War in Berlin in 1958, how Eisenhower responded to that, and what it might tell us, what it did tell us about how he might have acted in a more serious threat.
Well, you know, everybody was getting ready to fight conventionally. What happened here is that Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, gave an ultimatum. The West had to be out of Berlin in 6 months. Well, whoa, this is a big crisis. And a lot of Ike's advisors wanted to fight. And Ike said, no, we're not doing that. He actually withdrew troops from the area. But he made it clear to the Russians that if they came on, he was prepared to use nuclear weapons. And at the same time, he got Khrushchev to come to the United States so he could look at him face to face. And he did it very clearly. You know, Khrushchev blustered and threatened to send in the tanks. But Ike, and it looked like there was an impasse, but Ike took a nap, had an idea, got Khrushchev to come with him to his farm to Gettysburg and meet his grandchildren. This sounds kind of hokey, but it worked. Because, of course, Khrushchev had grandchildren, too. And Khrushchev backed off, withdrew the ultimatum, the crisis passed. It wasn't the end of crises. There were plenty more to come. But it was a kind of human insight that Eisenhower had to mix this big tough bluff with kind of human insight to make Khrushchev back down.
And in many ways, that was both sides of his personality, the bluffing, the threats, the temper, along with that geniality.
Great people are complicated. You know, really great, powerful people are complicated. They're not like you and me. They see the world differently. They are able to hold very contradictory ideas in their head and to be contradictory people. It gives them a kind of power that the rest of us just don't have, and Eisenhower was that way.
And in many ways, it was so different. The Eisenhower that we see in your book, the Eisenhower that we're coming now to really just understand in a broader sense, was so much more serious than kind of the Columbo-esque Eisenhower that we saw for so long.
Yeah, well, it was brilliant. The Kennedys did this. It was really smart PR. They wanted to contrast the kind of grandfatherly Ike playing golf with their own guy, JFK, who's young and handsome and debonair and dashing and all that. Really useful contrast in 1960, 61. But it stuck. People, you know, believe that Ike was this kind of doddering grandfather who liked to play golf. He did like to play golf. He played golf 800 times as president. But believe me, he was a busy, active guy. But again, he had the kind of confidence he didn't have to show off. I guess he paid for it in the history books because people didn't think he was that dynamic a president. I think my book shows and proves that he was.
Had he been more actively engaged, had he not played golf so much, had he taken more time, might he have avoided some of the mistakes that did happen along the way, the U-2 incident, the failed coups in Syria and Indonesia, had those things might have been avoidable?
Well, he didn't do a great job of supervising the CIA. That's true. And they ran some stupid coups that failed. They covered up the fact that the Soviets were capable of shooting down the U-2, and when the Soviets did shoot down the U-2 in 1960, it really derailed the effort for peace for détente. So that was a serious oversight. Now, could Ike have done a better job overseeing the CIA? Yes, I think so. He probably should have fired the director, Alan Dulles. Ike was warned that Dulles, that the CIA was getting kind of out of control. But intelligence is a tricky business, and Eisenhower said it takes a strange kind of genius to run the CIA, and that Allen Dulles was that kind of genius. In retrospect, that was a mistake. But at the time, you know, I can understand why he saw it that way. As his presidency went on, he was getting older and tired. That's true. He had a heart attack in 55, stroke in 57, a big stomach operation in 56. He was getting older and tireder, and he did take his eye off the ball a little bit, at least, towards the end of his second term.
It's interesting that with all the modesty and self-effacing nature that we've talked about, that he did see himself still as kind of an indispensable figure.
He did. I mean, he had a huge ego. I want to be clear about this. He had an ego the size of the White House. You can't be Supreme Allied Commander and not have a big ego. The question was how he controlled it. He had a big temper. He had a scary temper, and his aides saw it. But the public didn't see it, and his opponents didn't see it. You know, he was human. He could blow up. But he had tremendous self-control, and that's maybe something we could use a little bit more of these days. I mean, it's permissible now to be kind of cocky. I mean, President Obama, I think, can be kind of cocky, or at least people see him that way. I think it would go better for him if he was a little bit less cocky, if we were all a little bit less cocky. There was a kind of modesty and humility to Eisenhower's generation. Now, obviously not for everybody, but this need to control your ego, that was a good thing. It worked for Eisenhower.
It's hard to think of it, even especially for young people, it must be hard to think of it in the context of today, where everybody has to think of themselves as their own brand that they have to go out there and sell.
Absolutely, and I'm sympathetic. And I look at me. I mean, I'm a journalist. I'm always trying to get my name out there. When I first went to work for Time magazine in 1977, there were no bylines. Imagine that, no bylines. Nobody had their name on anything. It was a group process. We live in a different age. There's, you know, Twitter and Facebook, and, you know, you got to get your name out there. It was very competitive. My students, I teach at Princeton, they have incredible resumes. Well, when I was 18 years old, I didn't have a resume, but they have to have one now. I don't blame them. It's the society they live in. They got to show off. They got to, as you say, brand themselves.
In that context, what did Eisenhower think of Kennedy?
Well, he thought he was called him a whippersnapper. He thought he was kind of wet behind the ears, and, you know, this former Lieutenant J.G. was not ready to lead the free world. And when the Bay of Pigs happened, he really thought it, because Kennedy screwed that up. He should not have gone forward with that plan of attack.
But again, Eisenhower had to see it from the point of view of the CIA screwing something up again.
Right. No, that's true. That's true. What he was specifically, he thought that Kennedy didn't do a good job of checking in with the military on whether this thing would actually work. So he had an interesting conversation with Kennedy about it, and Kennedy promised to do better. But over time, Eisenhower came to respect Kennedy more. Kennedy did learn on the job, but fortunately for all of us, by the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy was a pretty good president.
Why did Eisenhower feel that he had to be a closet intellectual? He read a lot. He was much more educated and engaged in ideas than anybody had any idea about.
Yeah, I mean, some of this was politics. He wanted to be a regular guy. He didn't want to be a show-off. Back in the 50s, when you called somebody an egghead, that was a criticism. The Republicans like to call Adlai Stevens,
right,
the Democratic candidate. He was an egghead. He was an intellectual. He hung around with those East Coast intellectuals. So Eisenhower liked to play dumb. You know, I'm just a regular guy. I like to listen to Lawrence Welk and, you know, play golf. So he hid, and he once said he got ahead by hiding his ambition and his intelligence. So he was just kind of accustomed to that. But it's true, he did. He was actually extremely well-read, but nobody knew it.
You tell the story when he went before, and I don't remember what the incident was, when he went before the press and his aides asked him, an aide asked him how he was going to deal with it, and his answer was, I'll confuse them.
Yeah, he said, well, his aides were saying, God, you have to be really careful about this, Mr. President, well, this question and that question. And I said, oh, don't worry, I'll just confuse them. And he did. He gave a completely incoherent answer. Now, I don't know about you, but I would be embarrassed by that. I'm not sure I could do that. I need to try to appear smart on your show or anywhere else. Most people feel that way. Eisenhower didn't. He had the kind of confidence he could just pretend to be dumb, play dumb for a president. That's pretty amazing. Now, it didn't always work, but it often worked because it kind of deflected attention, and he was not shy with the press. He met them every other week more than any other president. He was out there, but he was willing to kind of be confusing if it was useful to him.
He was not afraid of the press at all.
No, he wasn't. He it was a different age, right? There's no cable TV. There's no Rush Limbaugh. It's a different deal. And there's no internet. But he met with the press every 2 weeks. No other president has done that.
The other interesting thing was the way he made decisions. And you talk about the fact that he never made a decision until he absolutely had to,
yeah.
Which goes against so much of what's taught even in business schools about leadership today.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm very impatient, but I kind of envy Ike. He could wait. You know, he didn't have to rush into things. We live in this age where it's all bam, bam, fast, fast. But I remember talking to a lawyer a couple of years ago who was holding his head because his young lawyers felt they had to answer the client right away, email them back right away, and they were making bad decisions. And he, the next day, this lawyer was having to go untangle the mistakes made by his young lawyers who felt the need to answer their client immediately. We live in this kind of rush age. I suffer from this. I whip off emails that are too hasty and too fast, and my wife has to come along and, you know, help me undo the damage. We just live in this kind of hasty world where you got to move instantaneously, and it's necessary, and it's appropriate, I guess, a lot. I mean, I sure do it. I'm sure you do, too. But Eisenhower, from an earlier age, was patient, and he knew that sometimes you just didn't have to decide. You could wait, and that was a good thing to do.
And in many ways, those instincts came from his ability also not only as a military commander, but as a card player.
Yeah, yeah. He was a great poker player. He injured himself playing football. Injured his knee, so he became a poker player at West Point. He was so good that he had to give up the game because he was taking up too much money from his fellow officers, his fellow young. So he switched to bridge. And in bridge, you have to be patient. You just kind of subtly signal your partner. You got to count cards. You got to think ahead. You got to see where it's going. You got to bide your time. And Eisenhower was a great bridge player, great card player, and he used those skills bluffing. I mean, that's the title of my book, Ike's Bluff. He learned how to bluff, and he learned how to communicate subtly with his partner, and he learned how to count cards and to think ahead.
In many ways, that really set the stage for everything else in his life.
It did. I mean, it may be too easy a metaphor. Titles we always in journalism we always simplify and exaggerate, as the saying goes. But he did. He was bluffing, and he really was bluffing with nuclear weapons. I'm not making that up. And he explicitly used poker analogies. In Berlin, we were talking about earlier, he said, you know, in Berlin, I'm not gonna be some slow going from the white chips, conventional forces, to the blue chips, nuclear forces. I'm going to push my whole stack into play. Those were his words at a national security conference. He explicitly used a poker analogy. And he said, the Russians will have started this war. We will finish it. That is all the strategy I have. He was going to another card metaphor was shoot the moon. It was all or nothing. He was an all or nothing guy. If he was going to go, he was going to go all the way.
Evan Thomas, the book is Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. Evan, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
This is great. Thank you so much.
Thank
you. Take care.
We'll take a break. I'll be right back.